Everyone, our next case is United States v. Smith. Captain Ward, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, sir.
Major Barris, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Captain Trevor Ward, and along with my co-counsel, Mr. Scott Hockenberry, I represent the appellant in this matter, Airman First Class Samuel Smith. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I'd like to request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, this case is about the government restricting content-based speech and that speech not falling within an unprotected category. And when that happens, that restriction is unconstitutional. Here, the breach of the peace conviction is unconstitutional and legally insufficient, and I'd like to first turn to the constitutional issue. For 75 years, the Supreme
Court... May I, not to get you off track here,
yes, Your Honor.
But... I'm interested in the interesting back and forth between you and the government over the issue of the proper definition of the word provoking. You point to Article 117 and say it defines provoking. Here we're dealing with that in 116 context. Government comes back and says, well, the word provoking does not appear in the actual article. And then you say in your reply brief, aha, but it was used in the context of the actual charge, and this was a alternative means of charging. My question to you is, what do we do about the fact that in Article 117, it uses the phrase, as used in this article, this is what provoking means. Does that indicate that that definition should be confined to Article 117? And furthermore, does that phrasing mean that the word provoking, in fact, is subject to various definitions within the code?
Your Honor, it's a combination. And the short answer to your question is Article 117 definition should apply to Article 116. And it's a combination of doctrines that get us to that conclusion. First, it's the doctrine of consistent usage coupled together with the rule of lenity, as well as the doctrine of vagueness. The rule of lenity and the doctrine of vagueness are at their pinnacle when free speech is concerned, which, of course, is what we have here today. And the doctrine of consistent usage does work in this context because you have provoking words in the Manual for Courts Martial as a way for the government to demonstrate breach of the peace. The Manual for Courts Martial does not provide a definition. And then on the very same page, not two paragraphs away, there is a definition for provoking words. Notably, that definition of provoking words matches almost word for word the Supreme Court's definition of fighting words. And as we articulated in our brief, fighting words exception for provoking words as uttered in the breach of the peace context must fall within that fighting words exception. So it's no wonder that the Article 117 definition follows that, and that's exactly why, one of many reasons, the Article 117 definition for provoking words should apply to the Article 116.
So that seems to suggest that that phrase that the President put in the manual has no meaning, or the President maybe is just powerless to limit the definition of a term to use in one article and not in the other articles.
Your Honor, it's not that it has no meaning. It's that coupled together with all the doctrines that I articulated, as well as the Supreme Court's precedent on fighting words, that gets us to the point where the definition from Article 117, the best reading of that, is that it should apply to the definition of provoking words under Article 116 in breach of the peace. Turning back now to the constitutional issue, the Air Force Court below used an ad hoc balancing test to assess and essentially confirm that the breach of the peace conviction was constitutional. The government asked this court to use a similar ad hoc balancing test today. The problem with that is that it flies in the face of 75 years of Supreme Court precedent, starting with at least Chaplinsky versus New Hampshire in 1942. Since that time, the Supreme Court has used a categorical approach, not an ad hoc balancing test, to assess free speech cases. In Stevens, the court cautioned against the use of such a test, and in Alvarez, just a couple of years later, in 2010, articulated that using an ad hoc balancing test for free speech analyses was startling and dangerous. And the reason it's startling and dangerous is because it allows the government to make these ad hoc balancing decisions and restrict speech without reference to any of the unprotected categories of speech, which the Supreme Court has laid out.
So is Bose just bad law?
Your Honor, Bose is not bad law. In a series of cases from 1942 to the present day, you see the Supreme Court explaining why certain categories of unprotected speech are not protected. In Bose, that case was about libel. And the court was simply explaining why, in their judgment, that category of unprotected speech deserves no constitutional protection. But the court still used, in that case, the categorical approach. In Counterman versus Colorado, Justice Kagan, writing for the majority, articulated that these categories and the categorical test itself was long familiar to the bar. There is, under that categorical approach, only one appropriate way to look at the facts of this case, and that's through the lens of the fighting words exception. The reason for this is because the Supreme Court, in every breach of the peace conviction that they've taken up, has reviewed breach of the peace convictions through provoking words as a fighting words exception case. Those cases are summarized on 11 through 13 of our brief, and there's been no Supreme Court case where they've assessed a breach of the peace conviction outside of the fighting words exception. The government concedes below that the fighting words are not applicable here, that these words do not constitute fighting words, but I just want to briefly summarize very quickly what the Supreme Court says fighting words are. They're first, personally abusive epithets, or second, personal invitation to fisticuffs. If it's not one of those two things, then the words do not fall within the exception, and if they don't fall within the exception, then the speech is constitutionally protected.
Well, counsel, what are we to make of the fact that the military has carved out this other exception, this what we call dangerous speech, a la Brandenburg?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So, go ahead.
The military has articulated a dangerous speech test on and off since this Court's predecessor, essentially. And first case was between United States versus Howe, and then following on with Priest, Brown, and so on. That test comes from a Supreme Court decision in 1919 called United States versus Schenck. That test was the test for incitement, the clear and present danger test, but it was abrogated in Brandenburg for a different incitement analysis, and that happened in 1969. Since 1969, no other federal court has used the dangerous speech test, and the military courts are actually the only courts left in the country that use a dangerous speech test some of the time. And so that test has been abrogated. It has not been used by the civilian courts since 1969. And perhaps more importantly is the problem that Justice Holmes had with that test. Justice Holmes is the individual justice who wrote the Schenck opinion, and his concern as time went on is that the government could use that test to essentially justify any free speech conviction or restriction on free speech in the country. And that's because it allows this kind of circular reasoning that the government attempts to adopt here, which is that so long as Congress prescribes behavior and that behavior encompasses speech, then the speech is not protected. That allows the government, as we articulate in our brief, to restrict any speech that they want so long as it's within the code. So this court should not use the dangerous speech exception that has been articulated, but even if it does, it should use the three-part framework used by this court in Wilcox. In Wilcox, you have a three-factor test for assessing free speech cases. The first one, the first factor is the speech protected? If the speech is not within one of the protected classes of speech, we don't have to worry about it because it's unprotected speech and we can move on. But if it does not fall within one of those unprotected classes of speech, true threats, incitement, fighting words, then you move on to the second step, which is, was there an impact on good order and discipline or the military mission? Here, the government concedes on page 22 of their answer that there was no impact to good order or the military mission, and it's easy to see how that's true, because this misconduct occurred off an installation at a civilian gas station to civilians.
Right, and so what, to that end, the Wilcox cases and its progenies were all arising out of Article 134 offenses. So is that test inapt or inapplicable when we have either a charge that is not grounded in 134 because you won't have a nexus? 134 requires a nexus. So if you don't have a 134 offense, you're not most likely going to have a nexus and or it's an offense that occurred off post as we have in this instance.
No, Your Honor. And for that proposition, I draw this Court's attention to this Court's predecessor in Howe and Priest, and to a lesser extent, this Court's decision in Brown and Wilcox, because the first of those three cases were not Article 134 cases. They were Article 92 cases for the most part. You have individuals disobeying lawful orders or disobeying.
Yeah, but then you have a clear military nexus. Well, when you have a plain common law crime that has no nexus to the military. Wilcox, is it your position that notwithstanding that, Wilcox must be the standard, must be the test?
No, Your Honor, not at all. Only if this Court decides to use the dangerous speech doctrine. I agree with Your Honor in that should this Court use the simple categorical approach by the Supreme Court and determine that these words are not fighting words, then there's no need to reach the dangerous speech test. And these cases are not cited in our initial filings. I'm happy to provide a supplement. But in the cases of Killian and Thompson, this Court used the categorical analysis for fighting words, not in the Article 116 context, but in the Article 117 context. Mm-hmm. And so this Court certainly can skip the dangerous speech analysis and go straight to the categorical approach, which is not only what the Supreme Court has done, but what this Court and its predecessor has done as well.
Okay, and thank you. And in your recitation of the three buckets, as it were, of unprotected speech, you mentioned true threats. Why would not these words fall within that exception?
Your Honor, the first and foremost reason is because the government did not charge it that way.
There is that, but, you know.
Yes, Your Honor. But the words do not fall within the definition as provided by Counterman versus Colorado or Article 115. And perhaps more to the point is that, again, in that Killian case, which was the Thompson case, which was an Article 117 case, mm-hmm. this Court's predecessor determined that the words spoken by the appellant were potentially true threats, but it didn't matter because they didn't meet the fighting words exception. And when we're talking about breach of the peace or we're talking about provoking words, it has to meet the fighting words exception because that's what the Supreme Court has told us over the course of at least 75 years since the decision in Chaplinsky. Your Honor, turning now to the applicability of the definition of Article 117 to Article 116. I've already talked about the three doctrines that play together to get us to that point where the definition from Article 117 can be applied. One additional point to make on that particular issue is this. In Gooding versus Georgia, which is one of the cases the Supreme Court took on for breach of the peace, the Georgia statute resembles pretty similarly to Article 116. The problem the Supreme Court had with that statute is that it did not specifically articulate the fighting words exception. So if the definition from Article 117 does not apply to Article 116, or alternatively, if this Court determines that the Supreme Court's definition of fighting words does not apply, Article 116 potentially faces a facial constitutional issue, as the Supreme Court articulated in Gooding versus Georgia. Either the fighting words exception applies to breach of the peace statutes in the provoking words context, or it doesn't. But if it doesn't, it falls victim to the same issue that the Georgia statute did in Gooding, which is that it's facially unconstitutional because it does not include that fighting words exception. And the last point I want to make on legal sufficiency has to do with the proof of a turbulent result stemming from the evidence in this case. The government chose a very specific charging regime in this case. They chose to charge breach of the peace through provoking words, to wit, and then listed out those specific words there on the charge sheet. They did not charge the loudness of those words. They did not charge any brandishing of firearms. They did not charge a squealing out of wheels. They did not charge a heating argument. They charged provoking words, to wit, a specific set of words. And there is no evidence in the record to suggest that those are the words that resulted in any turbulence. First, because no turbulence actually resulted, Ms. A.B. chuckled. She told Airman Smith to leave the property, and she called the police. That's what happened here. That's not turbulent. In their answer, the government talks about this third-party bystander who heard a loud conversation, but there's no evidence that it's the charged words that witness overheard. So even insofar as that's evidence of a turbulent result, there's no evidence to link the charged words to that interpretation.
Counsel, if we go with that theory, then we wouldn't even have to address the constitutional argument at all. We would just simply say the charge and the specification are insufficient because they don't allege, and certainly it hasn't been proved, that there's a turbulent result that occurred from those words. And we just say there might be a constitutional issue if it were otherwise, but we don't have to get to that constitutional issue. Is that your theory?
Your Honor, this Court could absolutely do that. You could still reach the constitutional issue if the Court was so inclined, but certainly if the issue is resolved on legal sufficiency with regards to the link between the charged words and the turbulence, then absolutely the Court need not reach the constitutional issue.
And can the conduct itself just be turbulent? I mean, if you look at some of our previous cases on breach of the peace, it's standing up naked in the beer hall shouting, and they don't say that there's other turbulence. It's just the act itself is turbulent.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. There are many ways that the government could both constitutionally and legally sufficiently prove breach of the peace. The primary way is through conduct. If you review both this Court's cases and the Supreme Court's cases, the convictions that withstand scrutiny from the courts are ones that are on conduct, not on speech. You can charge loud language. You could charge squealing out in the parking lot. You could charge potentially all of those things without it being a free speech issue or without getting into a turbulence issue. But in this case, that's not what happened. They charged provoking words and then charged a specific set of words that the appellant said. Chief Judge Alston, barring any questions from the Court, may I briefly conclude?
Further questions from the bench? Seeing none, please conclude.
Your Honors, when the government restricts content-based speech, and that speech does not fall within an unprotected category, that speech is constitutionally protected. Here, that's what happened, and because of that, appellant's conviction should be set aside. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain Ward. Major Barris. And please pull the microphone, get pushed away. Please pull the microphone closer to you.
Up. Yep.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court, I am Major Vanessa Barrows, and along with my co-counsel, Colonel Matthew Talcott, we represent the United States. This court should affirm the lower court's opinion for the following two reasons. First, appellant's speech is the very vehicle of the crime itself and was not constitutionally protected because he shouted a violent threat that was intended to incite imminent lawless action. Second, appellant's conviction was legally sufficient because his speech produced a turbulent response and a breach of the peace resulted when a group of people were yelling outside of a gas station where appellant brandished his firearm. As to my first point, Your Honors,
I'd like to focus first on footnote 3 of page 22 of your brief. We've got a situation here where service member was off duty. He was out of uniform. He was far from base, 85 miles or so. The other persons involved were not in the military, nor were they civilians working on behalf of the military. The basis for the interaction was not military-related. The appellant did not identify himself as being part of the military. And importantly, the key witness here said had no idea that he was in the military. So my question to you is, in a case such as this, is the government required to show some type of military interest that is sufficient to point to vindicate this idea that service members should not have the same First Amendment rights as civilian counterparts in a case like this?
Your Honor, the test set out in Wilcox is not applicable in this case. The test that this court should use is the test for civilian speech, in which the government would propose is the test under Brandenburg versus Ohio, which is incitement speech.
So if that's the case, if the government is conceding that, in fact, we should be using civilian test, then why are we not looking at provoking words? If we look at Chaplinsky, if we look at Texas v. Johnson, importantly, Gooding versus Wilson, Supreme Court is saying you have to have fighting words.
Your Honor, provoking, as articulated by the Supreme Court, which is fighting words, is not applicable in this case. The ordinary.
So I just want to be clear, though. You're saying that the civilian standard does apply here.
Yes, Your Honor.
But then you're saying the Supreme Court cases that spell out what the standard is don't apply.
The standard that applies here, Your Honor, is a standard set out in Brandenburg versus Ohio, which is the test for whether or not speech was likely to produce like imminent lawless action.
So the Supreme Court doesn't use Brandenburg anymore. The other civilian courts don't use Brandenburg anymore. But we're supposed to reach past Gooding versus Wilson and Chaplinsky and so forth and go based on our own military precedent?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court still used the Brandenburg test.
I'm sorry, I meant Schenck.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
I was referring to Schenck. So you're saying Brandenburg, but what about the provoking words from Gooding versus Wilson, the other case, Chaplinsky, and so forth?
So those statutes are different than the it is distinguishable from the Article 116 statute in Gooding. It's a very similar statute to one Article 117, which does have provoking words, which, you know, the definition of provoking words in Article 117 does match the Supreme Court.
So it's based on how the underlying statute is written. It's not a situation where, when it comes to First Amendment rights, breach of peace, they have to be fighting words.
No, Your Honor, the list of cases that appellant does cite, fighting words was applicable in that case, but those cases don't stand for the proposition that the only way you can breach the peace is to use fighting words. And here in this case, it is distinguishable from the line of cases from Chaplinsky moving on forward. Here what we have is appellant shouting a violent threat, which is not constitutionally protected, but also it is incitement speech, as this case has acknowledged in Wilcox and in Brown, otherwise sometimes used or talked as dangerous speech. But
now, I don't have it right in front of me, but when you're saying it was an inciting threat, in terms of the language that you did use, it doesn't sound like a classic threat. It's conditional nature and essentially saying, hey, the pretty boy in there needs to be aware that something might happen if he does something that he might do in the future. That doesn't sound like a threat.
Your Honor,
and it could be interpreted as him saying, I'm engaging in forbearance here. I'm not going to do anything, but he needs to be aware that other people are not so forgiving in the future.
Your Honor, just looking at the charge language, divorcing the charge language from its context is illogical. And if we look at what happened right after appellant said that threat, he brandished his firearm. Appellant referred to himself as the hard-hitting guy from the street, and that is evident from the facts raised at trial that he brandished his firearm.
Now, wait a minute. You're saying he said he was a hard-hitting guy from the streets?
Yeah, essentially the charge language is, you tell that pretty boy,
No, can you read it, please? I'll have to look through my notes. Can you read it?
So the exact charge language here is, tell that pretty boy in there that there are some hard-hitting people in the streets and he better watch his back, or words to that effect.
So how do you read from that he's saying he is a hard-hitting person?
Because if you look at the context of, and his conduct of happened immediately, right after the threat, he brandishes his firearm.
So how far back can the government reach after the words? We're talking about Supreme Court in a number of their cases referring to the sense of immediacy. The words had this immediate effect. The brandishing of the firearm happened later. Now, it's clear that it's permissible when determining whether the words are provoking or are fighting words, that you consider the context, but how much after those words can the government reach to say suddenly the words at the time that they were spoken were not provoking, but they became so after some other piece of the puzzle came onto the scene?
So the words at the time were provoking, even if when we use the ordinary language, ordinary definition of provoking, which is cause mild anger. So
now you're reaching to Merriam-Webster for that definition?
Yes.
You're not looking at case law, Supreme Court, on constitutional rights when you're reaching that definition of provoking?
Your Honor, as this Court held in Schlaf, absent a statutory definition, we look to the ordinary meaning of a word. And so that's what we use in this case. So we look to the ordinary meaning of provoking. And provoking in this case can also mean inciting, could also be threatening. It means all three. And appellant's words, because they were both provoking, inciting, as well as threatening, goes to show that his speech is not protected. Even the lower court characterized appellant's speech as a threat. And then moving on to the Brandenburg test, his speech was likely to produce imminent lawless action, and it did. I mean, appellant wanted to start a fight, and that's evident between the conversation that appellant had both.
Why not start a fight? You're saying he's inciting lawless action. You're saying the person who is going to engage in the lawless action was him. Well, he didn't need his own speech to incite himself to engage in lawless action. He would have just engaged in it. In fact, he did engage in some lawless action. He brandishes his gun, but that doesn't seem to be anything to do with his speech.
Your Honor, it has everything to do with his speech, because if you look at the context of what happened, you know, prior to the speech, and again, it's important to look at the context in which his charged speech, occurred. This was not the first altercation or the first, angry conversation he's had with me. I mean, they had a disagreement inside.
But how did she react? She chuckled and said, "Get your ass out of my parking lot."
Your Honor, the government submits that that is a turbulent response. We have to look at the environment with which we're in. We're in a gas station. There are families going into the store. There are people pumping their gas. It's not.
You're engaging in this parade of imaginary horrible. People pumping gas. What's going to happen?
But at a gas station, it's not reasonably to be expected that people are going to be cursing, people are going to be brandishing firearms, people are going to be yelling at each other. I mean, you go in there, you...
Why is none of that in the charge? I think even the appellant would concede, I don't know, put words in his mouth, that if this had been charged as incorporating some of the other actions that he took, it would be a very different disturbing the peace offense. But that's not the way the government elected to charge it. They charged it purely on the content of his speech, right? This is a pure content of the speech regulation by the government.
Your Honor, so the government charged breach of the peace to encapsulate all of appellant's misconduct. He was already charged with communicating a threat to Ms. In another clerk of the gas station. That happened the next day. But it wasn't just Ms. who was impacted by appellant's conduct the day of the incident. I mean, there were people at the gas station. We have, Mr. a witness who noticed that people were yelling.
But if he had said, instead of what he said, very loudly, "I am very unhappy with the service I've received at this gas station, and I'm going to take note of it," and then he left, there'd be no charge disturbing the peace, right? It's not really the fact that he yelled. It's really just the content of what he said. Like, that's what the government's theory is on why this disturbed the peace, right? It was, whether it was protected speech or not, it was distasteful speech.
Yeah, but the evidence that came out of trial is that, appellant is telling this, "You tell that pretty boy mother effer that there are some hard-hitting guys on the streets and that he better watch his back," or words to that effect. That's the evidence that came out of trial. It's more than just, your hypothetical, Your Honor, where he's just saying that, "I'm just dissatisfied with the service." I mean, his words are what are inciting some type of imminent lawless action. He wanted, potentially.
What was the lawless action that he was trying to, or that his speech was likely to incite?
Your Honor, appellant wanted to start a fight. Even if you look back at the.
If he wanted to start a fight, why didn't he start a fight? You're suggesting that, he was trying to maybe, the other patron who had defended was going to come out and fight him? Is that what he wanted? Is that the theory? That's what his language, but he left. He could have gone in and fought him if he'd wanted to.
Your Honor, appellant actually had an opportunity to leave after he left the gas pump, but he saw Miss at the front of the store, and he pulled up. He had to, put his foot on the brake. He had to roll down his window. I mean, these are the, conscious decisions that appellant is making when he is rendering, the unprotected speech. And he rolls down his window, and he is shouting, "Hey, you tell that pretty boy mother effer that there's some hard-hitting guys in the streets." I mean, that is a threat. And first, because of that, his speech is not constitutionally protected, but more than that, it went to incite imminent lawless action.
And your theory on the unprotected part is that it's dangerous speech. Because you also mentioned Bose in your brief, but you haven't mentioned it at the podium. Are you still saying, is that still an alternative theory?
Your Honor, it's important to note that the Supreme Court has cited, Bose and whether or not speech has a social value, even up as recent as, Counterman, but even going back to Virginia v. Black. I mean, the Supreme Court does look at whether or not that words have a social value. And yes, they, also ultimately fall back on a categorical approach, but it's necessary to look at whether or not there's any social value. And it, because that usually is what the Supreme Court then hinges on when they're creating, an unprotected category of speech. So although it's necessary to look at the social value.
Is there any case anywhere, because I looked, where a court has said, well, there are categories of unprotected speech, and this speech that we're dealing with in front of us in this case does not fit into one of those categories, but It does fit into the Bose standard, so we will decide that it is still, even though it doesn't fit into any of the other buckets, it's still unprotected?
There are not any cases that just hinge on whether on the Bose test. But I think the Bose test is helpful to this court because when we're looking at whether or not that this is actually incitement speech. I mean, if you look at appellant's words themselves, I mean, there is no social value whatsoever. I mean, he wanted to start a violent confrontation. We know this because when appellant was speaking to Mickey, a pretty boy, inside of the gas station, he told him, like, you know, stay out of this, man, if you, like, you know, don't want to get hurt. We have to look at this into context so that we can truly understand appellant's threat, you know, that is the charge language here. And so he wanted.
But in terms of the charge language, where do we have Supreme Court Texas v. Johnson says the invitation to fisticuffs? You keep on saying he wanted to start a fight. And Judge Hardy's point is, then why didn't he start a fight? Or why wasn't he more direct in his language? Tell that pretty boy MF-er to get out here. I'm going to kick his ass.
Your Honor, the standard, out in that case, fighting words is not applicable in this case. The unprotected category of speech applicable is incitement speech. And what appellant wanted to incite or otherwise stir up or provoke under the ordinary meaning is some type of, like, lawless action, is a fight. Now, his threat, because fighting words do not apply, his threat did not have to be, you know, in the presence of Mickey. He stated the threat to a third party. So even if, you know, on another alternate theory, even under, communicating a threat under Article 115, threats can be made to a third party. So again, I think, you know, looking at the Supreme Court precedent, Brandenburg versus Ohio, looking at the social value, as Your Honor has mentioned, helps us determine that his speech, in fact, you know, was unconstitutional, that it was to incite imminent lawless action. And there's even, you know, witness testimony that when appellant left the store and he's rummaging through his car, a reasonable fact finder can make the reasonable inference that appellant was looking for his gun at the time. And as soon as he pulled up to the store, made the threat to Miss AB, it is evident that appellant had his firearm readily available. And if it wasn't for the passenger in the car to put his hand down, who knows what could have happened afterwards.
So in the course of your response there, you're pulling in 113. Other times you're pulling in other articles. So then why can't the defense pull in 117 and say provoking words? The government used provoking words. So let's look at what provoking words mean within the code.
As Your Honor mentioned earlier, Article 117 uses very precise language as used in this article. And so provoking that, you know, captures the Supreme Court's definition of fighting words under Article 117 applies to Article 117 only. I mean, words have meaning, Your Honors, and it's mentioned as used in this article. An example I would like to pose to the court is that as used in this article is only used 7 times in the UCMJ. An example of that would be under Article 133, in which the President explains gentlemen. Gentlemen under Article 133 means both female and male officers. If we were to use the ordinary meaning of gentlemen under Article 133, it would just mean that only, you know, males would be, you know, held culpable under this article. So I pose this example to the court to demonstrate that when the President is using, as used in this article, to define, it has a very specific meaning and a very, like, specific legal term of art. And so if you look at provoking only appears under Article 116 in the actual model specification, which is not drafted by the President. It is actually drafted by the Joint Service Committee, and it's just a tool of how to charge. And so the government chose to charge using provoking language. But given all of these given all of this commentary, the fact that provoking is only seen in the model specification, it's not even defined anywhere in the statute or defined by the President, goes to show that the ordinary meaning of provoke applies in this case and not the definition provided under Article 117. So for these reasons, Article 117 definition of provoke does not apply in this case, and the ordinary meaning does.
So, please, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Chief. I just want to make sure I'm tracking, because the Chief noted that you were pulling in other offenses, but it appears when you look at all of the charges, it appears that the kind of the charging scheme was that the government charged each behavior or conduct separately. So the communicating the threat was a charge. Aggravated assault which was the brandishing the weapon, and so the actual speech you charged under the 116. So, I mean, so that's why you're arguing these other aspects, is because the other aspects of that behavior was a continuum of behavior, as you noted. It started inside the store, carried out to outside. He got in his vehicle, drives by, shouts the threat, brandishes his weapon, and then speeds off. So each little chunk was charged separately, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
And again, going back to, you know, a point that I made, I mean, even though that they were charged separately, we can still use the facts of the other crimes as res gestae in this case, which is why it's important to note that appellant brandished his firearms after making this threat, which goes to his intent to make a reckless threat, as the Supreme Court held in Counterman. I mean, it is a true threat, and you can tell through his reckless behavior by brandishing a firearm that he intended to carry out, potentially carry out that threat. Your Honor, I see that my time is time's up, but, you know, barring any questions, may I briefly conclude?
Further questions from the court? Please conclude.
So appellant has not met his burden under the plain error test to show that his speech was unconstitutional as applied to him. He failed to point to any specific facts in the record to overcome his burden under the plain error standard. Appellant's speech is not protected under the First Amendment, and his speech resulted in the breach of the peace. Thank you.
Thank you, Major Barris. Captain Ward.
Your Honors, I'd like to start my rebuttal with a question asked by Judge Hardy. And what happens when the Supreme Court deals with a case where there is no category applicable to the facts? The Supreme Court does one thing, usually. They hold that the conviction or the regulation is unconstitutional, and the conviction is set aside. In extremely rare circumstances, the Supreme Court will create a new category of unprotected speech, most recently with the child porn cases in the internet age. That's where we see that happening. Those are the two things that happen. But in this case, there's only one category of unprotected speech that applies. It's a category that has existed since 1942. The Supreme Court has always assessed breach of the peace convictions through that lens, and that is the fighting words exception. Throughout the course of this appeal, the government has articulated that the speech in question here is dangerous speech. They have articulated that it is dangerous speech under Wilcox. They have articulated that it is true threats. They have articulated that it is incitement. The problem with all of those theories is that that's not how the Supreme Court, this court, or this court's predecessor have ever assessed breach of the peace convictions under Article 116 or provoking words convictions under Article 117. Because of that, the conviction in this case is both unconstitutional and legally insufficient. The Air Force Court should be reversed and the conviction and sentence set aside. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, Captain Ward. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
Court stands adjourned until further order of the court.